In the coming week, Russia launches an invasion of Ukraine with wide-ranging consequences for international order. It's February 24th, 2022, and time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Jim Lindsay. Bob, as we tape this episode of The World Next Week, Russia has just invaded Ukraine. This is decidedly not the dispatch of supposed peacekeepers to the breakaway republics in eastern Ukraine that Russian President Vladimir Putin announced earlier this week. It's a full-scale invasion. Ukraine's three largest cities, Kyiv, Kharkiv, and Odessa, have been hit by cruise and ballistic missile strikes, and Russian troops have reportedly landed in Odessa. This is a fast-moving story that could be overtaken by events by the time this podcast airs. But can you tell us what we know so far?
Sure, Jim. And I'll be noting things I've seen from established credible media, as well as what I see to be social media feeds that have also been vetted or more vetted than you typically see in social media. And as you said, this is on multiple fronts, at least three different directions. Forces are coming in, land, sea, and air, it seems to be. There are look to be efforts by Russia to hit military targets, but not exclusively. There are plenty of reports and photos being shared of apartment buildings that have taken hits in major Ukrainian cities. There definitely seem to be firefights going on around airports, especially airports outside of Kyiv. Some reports have come in about Russian forces attempting to seize a Chernobyl nuclear plant. So it's widespread, and it is the massive invasion that U.S. officials had warned of repeatedly that Russian officials had denied they were going to take. The only other thing I would add, Jim, is that the invasion was launched with sort of accompanying comments from Vladimir Putin. And whether or not they were issued live or were taped comments, they're nonetheless ominous and some would say downright chilling, because it seems like it was much more than about Ukraine. It was about sort of grievances between Russia and the United States and the West more broadly. I would just add that he mentioned that any interference from outside nations will, quote, face consequences greater than any you have faced in history. So,
and I'll note, he then went on to talk about how significant the Russian nuclear arsenal is.
So he left little doubt that this was a threat of a kind we haven't seen before.
So, Bob, there are lots of questions we could ask. I mean, the first one to ask is, why has Putin invaded Ukraine? I've heard a lot of talk about NATO expansion, Russia feeling threatened. Is that the case?
Yeah, I think we can certainly point to that. There's been ongoing, dating back to the buildup we saw last spring, but even way before that, ongoing Russian grievances about NATO's expansion and NATO's ongoing engagement with Ukraine. And while it has not promised any sort of timetable for Ukrainian membership or approval of a membership action plan for Ukraine, it has continued to be engaged with Ukraine. And Russia has seen that. Putin and others, certainly in the Russian leadership, have seen that as a threat right up to Russia's borders of an expansion of an outside alliance. Although we should note there in no ways has this alliance ever posed a threat to Russia. But again, this is a matter of perspectives. It's also a matter of Putin's own worldview. And so I think, Jim, what we've now seen more recently is that Russia laid out what seemed to be a maximalist position towards the end of last year and into this year, saying, you know, basically we wanted, you know, NATO to peel back its deployments in the former Eastern Bloc communist nations, as well as a vow never to expand to Ukraine and sort of, you know, begin a dialogue on European security, stability, and so forth. Many of those were seen as non-starters, although there seemed to be openness towards some sort of dialogue, including the reviving these Minsk accords that were supposed to be settling the eastern provinces of Ukraine, that the separatist-minded eastern provinces. All of that is out the window now, Jim. We're really in a new territory now.
Bob, I'm going to take the opposite side of that proposition. I don't think that NATO expansion was a driving force behind Putin's decision. Yes, he has offered as a rationale, but it's not the reason. And it's not the reason, because Putin's bigger concern is that Ukraine is tilting to the West and particularly has a desire to become part of the European Union. That's a deep political threat to Putin's regime, because it suggests that there's a different way than Russia's way, and that the result of it will be essentially a contagion back in Russia itself that will weaken his own rule. And we will note that, you know, what Putin has tried to do, certainly in Belarus, is to prop up a regime that is also trying to crush sort of domestic democratic spirit, because that is a threat to his rule. And I think that's what this is really about, mixed in with this overarching agreement he has that Russia is not the Soviet Union, that it had lost lands that it dominated. In some sense, you know, what Mr. Putin wants is to go back to 1975, where the Soviet Union or Russia was the co-equal to the United States.
I happen to agree with you. I think the NATO narrative has seemed to be a compelling one, but it does also seem to be a bit of a distraction for the reasons you mentioned. I mean, if we just look back at the Maidan uprisings, which ended up, you know, leading to the annexation of Crimea, first of all, the ouster of a pro-Russian leader in Ukraine, but then leading to the annexation of Crimea and the Russian support of separatists in Luhansk and Donetsk and so forth, the real palpable concern about by Putin and his close advisors of these, what they refer to as the colored revolutions in former Soviet countries that were bringing in reformist, pro-democratic forces, they were seen as a direct threat. We should note that as the invasion was launched, there was a statement from Alexei Navalny, who's in court. He's the prime opposition figure in Russia. He was in court basically saying, this is the act of a clique of criminals who are running Russia right now. And he has been repeatedly mentioning that he sees this as a kleptocratic regime that is trying to preserve itself and save its own skin. And he has been extremely consistent in that. And that's a line of thought that has come up from a lot of Russian experts. We should also note the somewhat in the midst of the Putin comments, the kind of almost incoherence in that there was the expectation of a false flag set of operations in the eastern provinces that would lead the way towards an invasion there. Putin mentioned that initially, and then all of a sudden he skipped to the need to denazify and demilitarize Ukraine and oust the illegitimate junta and so forth. He's trying to build up Ukraine as this illegitimate country, and he's called it a puppet regime. He's called it any number of things, but not a country.
Well, but that's interesting, Bob, though, because in one of his speeches, he essentially blamed the Soviet Union for creating Ukraine and that it really is part of Russia. Now, of course, a big chunk of Ukraine was never part of the Russian Empire, the western part of Ukraine. So as a historical matter, Putin's argument is deeply flawed, but I'm not sure we need to go into the history of all of that. But this raises the bigger question of Putin's own stability. There have been reports saying that Western leaders who've met with him recently have found him to be particularly agitated and aggrieved, that his speeches tended to ramble or go on and on. What do you make of that?
I think that's a very valid point. I think among the leaders who spent the most time with him recently was Emmanuel Macron, who said he's clearly changed from his previous engagements. And there's been a lot made about the fact that under the pandemic, Putin has been very much walled off, literally and figuratively, from many of the other members of sort of the Russian leadership who might have seemed to be having moderating influences, or at least, you know, represented other voices for him to hear from, and is sort of more in touch day to day with a closer set of hardline advisors who in some ways could be egging him on, although again, these represent some core views that Putin has been expressing for years. But the pandemic effect, I think, is a real one. The question is how much this is now baked into what Russia does going forward, Jim. So we're talking, there are fluid developments going on. We don't know how long the battle for Ukraine is going to take, but there's a great deal of concern that it doesn't end at the borders of Ukraine. And in that, in fact, Putin is intent on pushing beyond that to sort of, you know, reestablish some sort of a line that existed at the end of the Soviet Union. So there's that whole set of issues. And then you're talking about NATO alliance members being involved and what does NATO do? And so another thing we should mention as we are taping this podcast, Jim, was that U.S. officials are meeting with G7 partners. There was a great number of consultations going on this morning between the U.S. and its allies. I think President Biden is due to speak early this afternoon. So he might say some things that come out after we've taped the podcast as well. So it's very much a moving thing. And there's a lot of concern about the state of mind of Putin and also what could be a deterrence with someone in this state of mind.
Well, before we get to the Western reaction and the downstream consequences of the invasion, just one last question for you, Bob, on this issue of NATO membership. Given that no one expected Ukraine to be offered membership in NATO anytime soon, and given the fact that Putin had been threatening Ukraine over NATO membership or the threat of NATO membership, why didn't Ukraine just disavow any desire to join NATO?
You know, it's an interesting point. There were some calls for that, although you were not seeing a lot of them from the sort of leadership structures from Ukraine that I saw. You saw it from some pundits about, you know, sort of trying to defuse the situation. I think what Putin's actions and his ongoing sort of ratcheting up of the situation had done was to, you know, cause the Ukrainians to double down, for one thing, on on wanting to assert their independence and wanting to be both free of Russia, but also be able to assert itself democratically. Ukraine's a country with a lot of problems. It's got deep corruption problems, and there are a number of oligarchs who have ties to Russia. But at the end of the day, it has had 30 years of freedom and has a sense of national identity and wants to maintain that. I think what's interesting also to know, Jim, is that like many other places, it was hard for the Ukrainian leadership to believe that such an invasion could really take place. And so that is something that we'll continue to look back on and determine whether that was a determining factor in terms of the readiness of the country to face such an invasion. But it was seen as unfathomable. And they saw this as, well, look, you know, you're not going to be able to change borders in this day and age. And we want to be able to make the choices as a sovereign, independent country. This is part of the calculus now that has to be reconsidered if Putin is intent on changing the borders and changing the calculus.
Bob, I want to talk about how Western countries, in particular the United States, are going to respond to the news of the Russian invasion. But before we do that, there's probably a preliminary question to ask, and that is, why does the invasion of Ukraine matter to the United States? And I pose that question because there are people who have been on TV arguing that this is of no interest at all to the United States. That seems to be the message if you watch Tucker Carlson's program on Fox News. I know the Senate candidate in Ohio, J.D. Vance, said he didn't care about what happened in Ukraine. So why is it that Ukraine is something Americans should worry about?
It's a good question, Jim. It came up at a meeting that the council convened just late yesterday, actually, in which a number of experts responded to that question from Richard Haass about the very same thing. Our colleague Charlie Kupchan was saying it's a first-order national security question if a country like Russia is now deciding that it is going to be able to change borders through the use of force, that it is going to plow ahead, and because of the prerogative of its leader, it can just, you know, go ahead and make this change, you know, create regime change and go about its business, potentially pushing further. It's a challenge to international norms, I guess, Jim. It's also occurring on the continent of Europe, where the U.S. has a large system of alliances and alliance obligations in NATO that could end up triggering a dispute that for now seems to be an economic one between the U.S. and Russia, but could get dangerously close to a military one.
So what do we expect the United States and European countries to do? I've heard a lot of talk about devastating, crippling sanctions. Do we know what exactly that means?
What I've seen is a combination of approaches that are aimed at getting at the heart of Russian business. Although we should note, Russia has attempted to sort of bulletproof itself against sanctions recently. It's reduced the amount of its assets that are dollar denominated, so that the impact of dollar transactions, if they were in some way affected by U.S. actions, would be minimalized. And that's not insignificant, because we've seen with sanctions against Iran, for example, that their ability to make transactions has been crimped by moves by the U.S. Treasury. So that's one thing. But I think it's doing business with Russia in the many ways in which it has valuable assets that bring in a lot to the Russian Treasury. So it's energy. It's a two-way street, though. Europe gets something like 40% of its energy from Russia. We've seen Nord Stream 2 already curtailed for the foreseeable future. But maybe, as some people said, maybe it's Nord Stream 1 as well. Maybe you put a real severe crimp into energy. Again, are Western countries able to take that hit? Is the global economy able to take that hit? We're seeing oil levels go up very high as we're taping this podcast. Global markets were, you know, retreating heavily, Jim. And then it's all sorts of other commodities that Russia possesses in great wealth. And do those somehow get some sort of a sanctions hold that crimps the sale in those? Again, Russia has built itself up in some ways to anticipate this moment with a war chest, for want of a better term, of something like $600 billion. And so it's certainly a message to set sanctions that we haven't seen before against Russia. But it's a question of whether or not they, at the end of the day, will change behavior at all.
Well, that's an important question, Bob. Why are we imposing sanctions? Is it merely to make the Russians pay a price? Or do we think it is going to deter them from doing something? Because I'll say, to this point, they haven't seemed to have provided much in the way of a deterrent effect, in part because of what you pointed to. Putin has been planning for this for quite some time, built up considerable foreign reserves. Also, prices of oil and gas have spiked in what is Russia's main export, oil and gas. So that sort of helps him. And then beyond that, there's the fact that sanctions very seldom have led countries to change their policies. So what's the point of the sanctions? What are we trying to do here?
They are a convenient, sort of readily available, although still difficult, step that comes up short of military action, obviously. And one of the lines of thinking is that if you make them severe enough, if you target them enough, if you use, say, smart sanctions, to use a term of art in recent years, you could influence the people who could influence Putin. So oligarchs are people in his close circle circle who have gotten very wealthy or who have holdings that are in international banks, who have holdings in London or, again, internationally, in ways that hit them, that might make them turn to the leadership and potentially eventually change its direction. Again, it doesn't seem like this is the short term. This is going to cause them to put on the brakes, Jim. It has not before. But also, people have pointed out that experts who have watched the situation with Russia have noted that following the 2014 annexation of Crimea, itself a historic, disturbing event, the sanctions were relatively mild at the end of the day. And again, since that time, Russia under Putin has appeared to have positioned itself in a way to be able to cushion itself from the blows of future sanctions. So it's an option. It's not the only option. There could be all sorts of other ways of isolating Russia that would make its leadership and its people, potentially take stock of what they're doing and whether they should continue doing it. But it's all these things are very tough. And at the end of the day, Jim, it's a question of whether or not Russia, as we have known it in its integration into the world, is going to be able to be walled off in some way, whether it's tech transfers, financial flows, diplomatic isolation. It's not clear. One other thing I would add, Jim, is that everybody's sort of looking with a great deal of anticipation to how China responds. It's been very muted so far. It has not come out and condemned it or made any comments that would seem to be condemning the Russian move.
So much for the Chinese position on the sanctity of sovereignty.
It has been, to the contrary. And we saw this even in the dramatic UN Security Council event that played out as the invasion was starting last night. Chinese officials had an opportunity to make a clear comment and did not. They reined it in. We could see a change, but at this point, they are deferring towards Russia. They are indicating, quote unquote, Ukraine is a complex situation and Russia has a lot to deal with on that front, but not in any way saying this is a threat to sovereignty, which is something you would have heard from the Chinese in the past.
So where do we see all of this going, Bob? I mean, when you throw a big boulder in a pond, you get ripples. I assume there are going to be ripples coming from this. What should we be looking for going forward?
Oh, that's a huge question, Jim. I mean, what are the, to use the diplomatic term, what are the off ramps here, or what are the ways of de-escalating this? It's hard to see that at the moment, again, as a full-scale invasion takes place that has been broadly condemned, was condemned at the UN Security Council meeting I mentioned, including the UN Secretary General. And yet it is happening. There is no indication that the Russians want to come to the table and sort of talk peace. Maybe there's going to be facts on the ground that cause them to change their mind, either them sweeping into power or putting into power someone in Kiev, to note one scenario, Jim. Or perhaps they face a tougher pushback from the Ukrainians than they expected, and they slow things down. This is all unprecedented territory for Vladimir Putin, who to this date has played his cards a little bit more cautiously, but effectively. It's not clear whether or not there is going to be some sort of consideration of a new norm or a new sort of landscape diplomatically for how Europe's security architecture is going to be laid out. I think there's not a lot of mood, certainly among the U.S. and its allies, to sort of placate the Russians at this point, to reward this type of action. And Russia has, under Putin, has got a full steam up at this point. And so we're kind of watching this play out in this sort of grim mode of surfing the web and seeing what's playing in Ukraine to see, what does happen next, Jim.
I think you're right that a lot depends upon what happens in the near term in terms of the fighting in Ukraine. Does Russia seek to control the entire country? Does it do so easily? Does it discover that it's much harder to do than it had imagined? Does it simply try to carve off the eastern section of Ukraine? A lot of possible ways this could go. But I will note that if Putin has decided that he wants to subjugate all of Ukraine, that opens up some very difficult challenges for the West. Robert Kagan had a piece in the Washington Post on Monday laying out the multiple ways that having a Ukraine dominated by Russia would challenge Europe, NATO, the EU. And again, we can go through some of the challenges right away. One, you're going to have the issue of refugees coming across the border, challenges that the Russians might try to engage in gray zone activities to create problems in places like Romania, Poland, Hungary, and the rest, and that could metastasize and create some real challenges for NATO and for the European Union, and that some of that is going to be encouraged by the fact that Putin is not going to take sanctions, particularly if they really are painful, lying down, that he's going going to look for pressure points to respond to and is going to try to do what he has been doing through much of his career, identify divisions within and between countries and find ways to deepen them, whether that's by paying off politicians or engaging in disinformation or any other variety of sort of gray zone activities, you can expect that to happen. And that will create massive headaches in Europe and for the transatlantic alliance, because I will note that the countries that will be on the front line, countries in Eastern Central Europe, are going to have much stronger opinions about this than countries that are in the Western part of Europe or the Southern part of Europe.
Well, that's a very interesting point and an interesting sort of venue, Jim, because I'm going to be watching in particular how some of these countries, especially ones where you've seen this kind of move towards illiberalism, how they continue to respond. Viktor Orban of Hungary has made some concerned statements so far. You've had the usually sort of pro-Russian president of the Czech Republic, Zeman, also speaking out against the invasion of Ukraine. You've had Poland has already been very much, although there's been a move towards illiberalism there, they've been very much concerned about what's happening in Ukraine and are looking to build up forces on their border, which will then be a front line. And also will be a front line potentially for refugees, Jim, which is the other outflow here. We're seeing, again, in photos and videos shared on social media, you're seeing lines of cars streaming out of Kiev. Presumably, you'll see some population flight. The Czechs have noted that they will offer visas to Ukrainians. We'll see how many gestures like that we see in the region. But that region is one area where the pre-existing divisions we watch very closely. I'm also kind of interested in the United States, Jim, in terms of how much the political establishment responds to this. We've seen certainly divisions involving former President Trump and his reaction. Among other things, he said this invasion never would have happened on his watch, but he also called the moves by Putin beforehand genius. You've had the Fox News commentators weighing in, some of them taking clearly a Russian side in this. This is all kind of new territory as well. I'm going to be very interested to see how it plays out, both in the next couple of days. And then we have the State of the Union next week, Jim, which is going to be high theater, I think.
Certainly going to be, Bob. And, you know, in all of this, I think it is time that will be a very big factor. Right now, in the immediate aftermath of the invasion, you're seeing a great deal of solidarity within Europe and in the transatlantic relationship. The question is going to be, are we going to have that same kind of solidarity 6 months, 12 months, 18 months down the road? I will note that for Washington, this creates a real challenge because at the time when the Biden administration was hoping to focus on dealing with China, it is now going to have a lot of its energy devoted toward what to do about Russia. And again, a lot of commentary about how 50 years after Nixon's visit to China, the script has been flipped on its head. Nixon went to China to try to drive a wedge between Russia and China, sort of get a two countries, United States and China, against Russia. That drove geopolitics for the next several decades. Now we have a situation in which Russia and China look to be pairing off. How does the Biden administration respond to that? Does it still try to pursue a foreign policy that is essentially hostile to both countries, sees the United States as engaged in a geopolitical competition with both, but primarily with China? Or does it make a recalculation and decide that Russia is now the more immediate problem, the one more disruptive to international order, and the best way to respond to that is by dialing it back in dealing with China and try to find some way to reduce the tensions between Washington and Beijing? Now, that's easier to speculate about than to find a way actually to do, because clearly Xi and Putin have a meeting of minds on a variety of issues that was made clear by that communique that they issued on the eve of the Olympics.
No, it's worth pointing out. It's also going to be interesting to see how much there is actually common cause between Russia and China, the two great authoritarian powers in the world, and how much they're different and how much that might come into play. It's been pointed out recently by a number of experts that China, for all of its many problems and abuses, including an ongoing concern about genocide in Xinjiang, which came up at its hosting of the Winter Olympics, that China looks to benefit from an orderly international system. It has certainly benefited economically from that, and that disruptions to that are not necessarily something that China welcomes, whereas Russia has been a disruptor in a number of ways, especially recently, whether you look at its sort of permitting cyber attacks on its watch or some of the other things going on, and obviously up to the present day with the invasion of Ukraine. Look at the way they responded to the pandemic, which, by the way, by all accounts, originated in China, but China still went systematically about, you know, adopting a zero COVID policy and has been almost brutally effective. Russia has been quite a different portrait in its response. It's had a disaster disastrous response to COVID. One of the reasons, by the way, that Putin might have walled himself off from contacts because he was concerned about the spread of COVID as well. And these are just very different systems while still being authoritarian. Is there enough common cause there, or can China be picked off in some way by the U.S., as you indicate, Jim? That's going to be really interesting to watch.
All of that is true, Bob, and it raises a related question, which is, how is Beijing reading the events of today? A lot of speculation going on, and it's just that, speculation about how Beijing might read Ukraine and its impact on Taiwan, obviously a potential flashpoint in U.S.-Chinese relations. Does Beijing view Ukraine as a sign of U.S. weakness, which might encourage them to take back Taiwan more forcefully? Is it the case that the Chinese might decide that the United States is spread too thin, hence it won't be able to launch a response? Or is it exactly the opposite, that Beijing realizes that the Biden administration would have to do something more than just apply sanctions if China moved on Taiwan?
No, it's an area that has gotten immediate attention in the midst of everything, Jim. Again, you mentioned the Robert Kagan piece in the Washington Post, which is about sort of these two fronts that are going to challenge the, you know, the U.S. geopolitically, and they both have their near abroads that they care about. I mean, you had, right after last night's events, you had Taiwanese President Tsai Ing-wen calling for an increase in surveillance of military activities near Taiwan, which already have been increased in recent months. And China's foreign ministry came out with a statement saying, quote, Taiwan is not Ukraine. But it's still something that bears watching, because it gets back to the U.S. credibility as a power, and also the U.S. willingness to use force to support its allies, or in the case of Taiwan, you know, an entity that has had U.S. support through the Taiwan Relations Act, and it gets its primary military support from the U.S.
And obviously, these are not the only big diplomatic issues that could be affected by the Ukraine invasion. And I'll just note, there was a lot of optimism that the United States, the other P5 members, were going to strike a deal with Iran to bring Iran back into the nuclear deal from 2015. Indeed, the Russian ambassador who's involved in this tweeted out that he thought this was likely to happen. Do we have any sense of how Ukraine and the reaction to the Russian move is going to affect whether or not we get a Iran that returns to the JCPOA?
That is going to be another one of the compelling storylines to follow, Jim. We have noted before that even as circumstances between the United States and Russia, for example, have gotten worse and tensions have risen, that they were able to compartmentalize issues like the Iran nuclear talk process, which is of a high priority for the Biden administration, right up to this week and through this week, where you had, by latest reports, a chief Iranian negotiator going back to Tehran for what were seen as a final round of sort of agreeing on aspects of the deal that could put it back into play. We're looking at, by many accounts, Jim, if that does happen, a very modest resumption of the deal, basically coming back to what the deal was. It's not even clear whether that's going to be allowed under some checks that seem to have been set up under by U.S. lawmakers about any return to an Iran nuclear deal. But be that as it may, Russia was very much part of this process. U.S. has not been meeting directly with Iranian negotiators. There have been this kind of shuttling back and forth in Vienna, and Russia has been locked into those talks and has been talking regularly about things moving forward. I don't know whether, you know, the credibility of Russia as a partner in a crucial deal like this, whether that can withstand what's going on in Ukraine right now.
Well, all I will say is I'm glad I'm not the person who is responsible for writing Joe Biden's State of the Union address. You mentioned the SOTU a bit earlier. He's going to speak next Tuesday night to the nation, and he's going to have a very tough challenge, because obviously national security issues are front of mind to people like us. But for a lot of Americans, what they're really interested in is what the Biden administration is doing here at home. And of course, we have the pandemic. Still exists, concern about variants of Omicron that may be even more transmissible. I think it's going to be a big challenge for the president to find what the narrative theme of his speech is going to be, because there are just so many issues that he could talk about and perhaps should talk about.
Absolutely, Jim. I mean, it goes without saying that the country has really reached a high point in polarization. The State of the Union, still in all, provides an opportunity to get a big audience, including people who don't necessarily support the president, watching because they want to respond to it or have a take on it or whatever. Biden has an opportunity to coin some phrases. We often hear important terms come out of State of the Union speeches. We heard the axis of evil phrase come out in the aftermath of the 9/11 attacks from George W. Bush. George W. Bush also at another State of the Union, I think, referred to a U.S. addiction to foreign oil, which was, you know, triggered a number of moves towards sort of ramping up domestic production, which continued actually quite a bit, we should say, under President Obama. And so we'll see whether President Biden is able to make this a signature moment where he's able to find, at least on the issue of Ukraine, enough common ground where you see both Democrats and Republicans stand to applaud. There's a great deal of sort of theater that goes into certain touchstone phrases and issues. And most recently, you've seen one side of the chamber sitting, you know, mutely while the other side cheers. Will there be these moments of them getting together and at least rallying around Ukraine? It's not clear. Will there be a Ukrainian invited? Sometimes there are invites to the State of the Union, Jim, where you have people there. They tend to be American, labeled American heroes of various sorts. Will Ukraine resonate to such an extent that a Ukrainian is invited to appear as a guest and sort of bring some sort of unity? It's going to be very interesting.
Yeah, that will be interesting to watch, Bob, in part because as things stand right now, attendance at the State of the Union is restricted to members of Congress and no additional guests are going to be allowed. But, you know, as you already alluded to, there is some division on the Republican side of the aisle about how to respond to what happened in Ukraine. You can have former President Trump talking about Putin's genius and savvy, and you have former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo talk about how much he respects Putin. Again, not the reactions we are used to seeing in opposition leaders to actions taken by countries that have been hostile to the United States, but it shows how deeply divided we are as a country, but also the divisions that exist within the Republican Party. Because again, there are many Republicans, Lindsey Graham perhaps comes to mind first and foremost, who are critical of the Biden administration, not because they don't think the United States has an interest in Ukraine or that they have respect for Vladimir Putin, but because they wanted Biden to do more. And so I think you're going to have Republican critiques of Biden that come from different parts of the intellectual spectrum.
Yeah, and it gets back to your earlier question, Jim, about, you know, why does this matter and what's at stake? I think it's also what our elected leaders see is at stake and how they convey that, not only following, you know, maybe what the mood is in the country, but maybe trying to guide the mood and saying, look, this is important. You certainly had a bipartisan group that went to the Munich Security Conference just this past week, emerging with a seemingly unified voice about supporting Ukraine and taking the steps to support Ukraine. We'll see if that translates and that holds up locally.
The one thing I'm going to be looking for, Bob, going forward is what public opinion polls show. Because traditionally in crises, what you see is a rally around the flag effect. As people see the United States as potentially being threatened, they come and rally around the president and actually also around Congress and other institutions as well. Now, sometimes that effect lasts quite a while. Think after 9/11. Sometimes it only lasts a couple of weeks, maybe a couple of months. But the question is going to be, do we get anything at all? Or is this going to be yet another instance in which a big event happens and everybody breaks up into their teams?
Well, Jim, it's only February and 2022 has been exhausting. Let's see what the next week brings.
I fear it's going to be turbulent for quite some time.
Well, that's our look at the world next week. And there are other things going on in the world, and here's a few things to keep an eye on. Ukraine's neighbor Belarus holds a referendum on constitutional amendments. Mali has a general election, and Malaysia's prime minister visits Thailand.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts, and leave us a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. The articles, books, and podcasts mentioned in this episode are listed on the podcast page for The World Next Week on CFR.org. Please note that opinions expressed in The World Next Week are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program was produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Sherling. Zoe also did double duty as our recording engineer. Thank you, Zoe. Special thanks go out to Margaret Gatch, Nicholas Martinez, and Rafaela Seward for their assistance. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons. This is Jim Lindsay saying goodbye.
And this is Bob McMahon saying so long, and please be careful out there.